Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
And welcome to Everything is Fine, a podcast for women over 40. I'm Talia Bacassus.
And I'm Kim France.
So today we have Lisa Lucas, the outgoing executive director of the National Book Foundation and incoming senior VP at Knopf Doubleday. Welcome, Lisa.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah. Those are two really cool jobs. Did you always know you wanted to go into publishing?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think I was like, I get asked a lot about like what I wanted to be when I grew up, when I was a kid. And I don't think I had any real sense at all. I was always a reader. I always loved books. But I think right when I graduated college, I became a much more serious, like independent reader, like beyond just the books that were being given to me in classes. And then I ended up working in theater and film. And I guess when I left Tribeca in end of 2011, I felt kind of like, I'm reminded of this long desire to work in books and how much I enjoy this particular format. And maybe that's what I'll do.
I read on your Wikipedia page that you were an intern at Vibe when you were 15.
Mm-hmm.
How could you be an intern at 15?
My mother worked in advertising, and I think she knew the publisher at Vibe at that time. And I needed something to do in the summer. And so they just like kind of allowed this little 15-year-old to hang out. But my mom probably needed like childcare in the summer. You know, like 15-year-old, don't get into trouble. And that's how it happened. But I definitely was like so intrigued by the work.
So you're the executive director of the National Book Foundation that runs the National Book Awards. What are those?
The National Book Awards are probably, you know, we always think about it as like the Oscars of books. And it's crazy because this year it has to be digital. So we've for 71 years held like a ceremony. And this is going to be the first year that we don't have a physical ceremony. But, you know, we do fiction, nonfiction, poetry, translated literature and young people's literature. But we're part of like a bigger nonprofit. And so we do a lot of work trying to build readers, you know, and trying to get people excited in reading, especially like communities that have not been considered the audience is a lot of our focus.
Right.
You know, how do you get into rural spaces? How do you, you know, we gave 1.4 million books to kids and families in public housing over the years.
Right. So you're not a book recommender per se, but as somebody who is running that show, you have your finger incredibly on the pulse of what's happening with books. So I really want to hear your book recommendations. But let's just go around this invisible table. Kim, what are you reading right now?
I am not at all ashamed to admit that I am reading The Chiffon Trenches by Andre Leon Talley, which is a very fun book, you know, very entertaining, and nobody really gossips or talks out of school about Anna Wintour, and he really does. And, you know, he was super betrayed by her, you know, and it's just interesting to read. It's interesting also because it's such a time capsule. Magazines just aren't that way anymore.
How was he betrayed by her?
He got old, you know, he got old, and she just, you know, left him behind.
Didn't she get old too?
Yeah, you would think. You would think.
She's got the sunglasses that protect her from aging.
Tally, what are you reading?
I'm reading Luster by Raven Leilani, and it is making me feel a little bit old. I think there's a lot of sex in it, and there's something that the new generation of writers do where they write really explicit sex very casually. And she'll just throw in like where, you know, like I sat on his cock or like really, really explicit things where I'm like, oh, my God, like, you know, it's Sally Rooney, like all these younger women owning their desire. But it makes me still squirm a little bit.
I'm sort of in love with it. You know, I mean, I think,
yeah.
You know, it's like reading Nicholson Baker and Henry Miller and Philip Roth and, you know, James Salter. I mean, it's like, you know, this is old work. And they were talking like that many, many years ago.
Right.
You know, it's interesting, you know, because it's just like Luster is exciting in a lot of ways because you see finally a black woman actually being published, you know, to the general marketplace who is writing about explicit sex. It's like I was watching Insecure recently, and it was so interesting because when was the last time you saw two black people joyfully having sex without like a plot line that leads to pain?
Right.
Yeah, so, no, you know, I mean, it's just like, but there's so many representations of white folks joyfully having sex everywhere, you know, and also just that explicitness. I mean, it's like that's existed. It's just, I think it's so shocking. You know, we've just never seen these stories to scale. I mean, I've always been like, why don't we have an explicit sex book?
I guess I'm just, maybe I compartmentalize a lot. And so I haven't always had that in my relaxation reading.
Well, no, I don't know if it's relaxing. would definitely not argue that that's necessarily like the most comforting writing. But I do think that who is allowed to be obscene or explicit or titillating is changing. You know, also the way that those books enter the mainstream is changing.
How so?
Like, I think Luster has been marketed as this, like, you know, very sexy book. And, you know, people are sort of like, wow, you know, she's so... But the 50 Shades of Grey sold more copies than anything else on planet Earth.
Right.
But 50 Shades of Grey was marketed as that, like, as a sex book. Like, and I didn't read it because I was like, oh, it's just softcore porn is what I was made to believe it was.
Yeah, but it's just, it's interesting how we, how not individuals talk about sex in books, but how we collectively think about sex in books. All the way from the publication, the writer, the publication, the critical apparatus, you know, all the way through. It's just fascinating.
What are you reading right now?
I am still wading through Isabel Wilkerson's Cast, which is wonderful. It's very, 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 I mean, wonderful in the sense that it's wonderfully well written and rigorously, you know, thought out and researched. I don't know that the subject matter is so wonderful. You know, but, you know, what book about America right now is?
Right.
And that's a book also where she makes comparisons to the Indian caste system as well.
And sort of really reframes how we think about class and race in a new framework, you know, using this lens of caste. And I think it changes, you know, I think a lot of times people are like, oh, discrimination isn't about race because there's so many people who aren't people of color that are being discriminated against because they don't have any money. It's about class. This is all our one problem. And that's always been met sort of with, you know, a decent amount of unhappiness by people of color, I think, because it's not the same. And there are specific rules for how we govern communities of color in this country. She really does a great service by trying to give us another tool with which to look at how we've organized ourselves into haves and have-nots and what race means for that system.
Well, that actually dovetails with another question that we have, and I wonder if this is your answer. What to you is the best new book by an author of color, or are there several?
Gosh, there's so many. I mean, I think that we've been in, you know, a multi-year cycle of incredible, extraordinary work being written that's different from the narratives that we've seen for so long. I mean, I'm just looking right now at like a little shelf of books, and I'm seeing Megha Majumdar's A Burning. I'm looking at Percival Everett's Telephone. I'm looking at Charles Yu's Interior Chinatown. You know, I think we saw Kathy Park Hong come out with a really incredible book this year. Britt Bennett, Luster. You have just so much extraordinary work that's coming out right now.
Do you have a fiction recommendation for someone who has a pandemic-related attention span problem? And by someone, I mean me.
I mean, I have the same problem. You know, it's like just because you work in books doesn't mean you're not affected in the same way and your reading isn't affected in the same way. One of the books that I feel like really early on when I absolutely was just so frightened and despairing was Saga, which is a graphic novel. It's actually not brand new. It's kind of like a space opera about two planets that are fighting this proxy war all over the universe and you know, a couple that comes from both of those planets and generally do not intermix. And, you know, it's a family drama and a war drama and a space saga. And it's really smart and it's really fun. It's a compulsively page-turnery in the way that comics often can be. And it just, like, absolutely took me all the way away from where I was.
Wow.
Which I thought was fabulous.
Oh, I love a graphic novel. That's great.
Yeah, me too. Even though summer's at its end, what would you say is the best summer beach read for someone who wants to pretend that they can be on a beach right now?
I think the gold standard for me, when I think about stories that are happening on a beach that make me want to continue reading, is The Neapolitan Quartet by Elena Ferrante. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, I just feel like even if you've read it before, like, you know, you're all of a sudden you're somewhere completely different from where you are, and you're a teenager, you know, negotiating romantic entanglements on a beach in the summertime when you're bored out of your mind. And it's just like such a great series of books to be transported, enraged, entertained, confused, right. You know, enriched, and to spend a little time at the beach.
You sort of answered my next question, because which was, what's the best beach read that you don't have to feel guilty reading? Those, mm-hmm. obviously, you don't have to feel guilty reading, but what are some others?
I don't think you have to feel guilty about any book, honestly. Like, a book is a book, and somebody, if somebody wrote a book and it's like 350 pages long, like, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's like you're allowed to love what you love. Like, so I'm anti-guilt. Read what you like.
Me too.
You know, I think that that's like really important. But I'd say that like a good Samantha Irby's Wow, No Thank You.
Yeah.
Is like, oh, yeah. I think we sometimes are like, oh, humor is not real writing. And humor is, in fact, real writing. And some of the people who make, you know, sort of our most like hilarious TV shows, they're writing, you know. But it's right. Like, but I think Sam Irby, that book is so smart. And it's like about, you know, I think she's exactly the same age as me. And I just feel like it felt very nice to feel seen by someone so funny, you know, as a woman in the world, you know, sort of navigating just like being 40.
Yeah, we're big fans of Samantha Irby. She came on the show a while ago. We're all for her.
Yeah, she's awesome. She's hilarious. Yeah.
What's the best biography you've read lately?
You know, I have to say that with the attention span situation, I have not been diving into any, like, you know, 900-page, like, biography showstoppers. I truly just have not.
Well, what are one not so lately that you've liked?
Gosh, there's so many interesting biographies that I have loved over the years. I suppose I go back to Bob Caro, Robert mm-hmm. Caro.
Mm.
Always. And I have not finished the LBJ books.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sort of dip in because I just always want there to be a little more to read. I don't want to run out because he's so beloved to me. That's just been such an extraordinary journey and so rigorous and so detailed and so unique that it's always the thing that I kind of, you know, the art of the biography is really on full display in anything that Bob Caro writes.
My favorite Bob Caro story is that he moved his wife to the Texas Hill Country in order to research that LBJ book. I think she said something to him like, couldn't you have been interested in somebody in Paris?
Well, Ina was his partner. You know, she was the only researcher that's ever worked on any of the Robert Caro books.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he couldn't do the work without her there.
Right.
That's one of my favorite stories. But yeah, she was the only researcher that's worked on those books with him.
It's fascinating. How about memoirs? What's a memoir you really love?
Sarah Broom's The Yellow House, which just came out in paperback, which is the story of the house that she grew up in New Orleans East. It won the National Book Award last year.
Mm-hmm.
And is this extraordinary book about cartography and memory and family and architecture and homes and race and, you know, generational wealth and all sorts of things. It's really, really an extravagantly good work of autobiography or memoir.
Mm. I feel like there's something on the surface of my memory here. Is there a good memoir that came out recently that was a graphic novel? What am I thinking
of? Sure there was. I think that there have been a lot of really interesting graphic novels that have been memoirs, but I do not know which one you're speaking of.
Oh, I know. I know what it is. I'm thinking of it's for children. My son was reading Guts by Raina Tegelmeyer.
Oh, fun. Yeah. I've never read those books, but...
Oh, they're really fantastic. A lot of the kids' graphic novels are really wonderful, and she's really great. It's a book about having anxiety over your body and about vomiting and, yeah, this very specific kind of anxiety.
Hmm.
Yikes. I am glad to be an adult.
Yeah.
I think it extends.
Who do you think is a great under-heralded author?
Percival Everett. who is a fiction writer who's very prolific and extravagantly talented. I would say actually him and his wife are both underrated authors. Danzy Senna, who wrote New People in Caucasia. Percival's new book is called Telephone. And actually, there are three separate endings. So there are three different editions living out in the wild.
Wow.
Oh, no way. And you would not know which one you get. Mm-mm. Obviously, you can know the end before you get it. But I mean, like, if you wanted to read all three, are they indicated on the cover?
The copies that I had were indicated for me. So I don't know. I have three copies of it, and so I have all three of the endings. But I do not know how they actually put it out into the marketplace. But he's just always been a favorite. He's funny, extraordinary social critique. He's been publishing for many, many years. And I think that he does. He's like kind of like a cult favorite. But I think he should just be like a favorite.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough, yeah. A book that I read years ago that has stuck in my mind for a while is A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan, which I think everybody loved. But I'm trying to find a book that strikes me the same way that book struck me, that spanned generations and, you know, had such a big heart.
Pachinko by Min Jin Lee. Sounds like what you might be looking for, which is about a Korean family who moves to Japan and goes over multiple different generations. And it's just an extraordinary story. Also a National Book Award finalist and a really wonderful book.
I feel like we're in a bookstore and you're like the most knowledgeable possible bookstore clerk. This is perfect.
I know.
That book is very different from The Goon Squad, but it's also just really takes you through time in a way that is extremely absorbing and wonderful.
Great. Our show notes are going to be so long for this show.
I know. I should have said off the top, we were going to put these in the show notes, and I'm going to have to go through and like try to figure out all the names that you said, but I will do it. We're going to take a quick break for some ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Support for Everything is Fine comes from Ritual. Did you know that hyaluronic, wow, what a hard word, acid naturally occurs in our skin but decreases gradually as we age? Like, I've been doing so much research on skincare, and this is one of the biggest things. Hyaluronic acid and collagen, both of them are huge things that make us look older. And this decrease can cause skin to become thinner, drier, and more prone to wrinkles, right? So Ritual's Hyacera supplement is clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and improve skin smoothness. I love Ritual. I've been talking about Ritual for months. I use the Ritual Multi. I use the Ritual Daily Protein. I've even gotten into the Ritual Melatonin to help me sleep. Ritual's products are clean. They taste good. They smell nice. They are not unpleasant. They're also aesthetically pleasing, which is nice to have them on your counter. So Hyacera is a once daily skin supplement that's clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. In a clinical study, Hyacera led to 3.6 times the reduction in crow's feet wrinkles within 90 days, as I said at the top, as compared to placebos. It really works. It's made my skin, for me, it makes my skin plumper, juicier. It's super easy to bring into my routine. So listen, you can get Hyacera too to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/fine. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/fine for 25% off.
Welcome back to Everything is Fine. Do you have a best first book by an author over 40?
You know, that is a great question. And I feel like I would have to really dive into Wikipedia to try and figure it out. I don't know. I mean, I think there's an extraordinary number of women writing great books. Who started after 40? I don't know. I have a feeling, I think Annie Proulx and started late, probably in her late 30s. Although you'd have to fact check me on that. I think also, beloved Canadian short story writer.
Oh, yeah.
Alice Munro.
Thank you.
I believe started later in her career.
I'm Canadian,
as well.
Lisa.
It's funny. But yeah, I think Alice Munro started later too, but I really couldn't tell you. But I suspect that there's a lot more than you think there are. I don't think it's like so strange for people to write their first book in their 40s.
No, I'm trying to write my first book in my 50s.
Mm-hmm.
How about books by older women about older women?
Books by older women about older women. I mean, I really liked Meg Wolitzer's most recent book, which is about mentorship and really like explores that sort of generational divide between a young woman on the come up and a woman who's sort of like mid to late career and what their relationship is and what mentorship can look like and what's complicated about it and what's not and feminism across different generations. And I thought that that was a really interesting one.
The Female Persuasion.
Yes.
And I'm not going to go ahead and call Meg older, but, you know, she's definitely a veteran writer.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have books you find yourself returning to repeatedly?
Yeah, there's definitely a couple. The House of Mirth is something that I really love.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read that book several times or just kind of like popped back in and seen, you know, just like what's going on with everybody. How's Selden? How's, you know, how's everybody hanging in there? How's Lily? So The House of Mirth is definitely a book that I return to again and again. I feel like I often return to Studs Terkel's books, Working or the book about, you know, the Great Depression. And those are oral histories, so it's always nice to kind of pop in and just read a few selections from it. But he's always been one of my favorite writers.
Mm-hmm.
What excites you most about your new job, going into your new job?
Well, I think I'm really excited about things changing a little bit. I mean, I think that, you know, publishing is definitely in the middle of a real reckoning itself. Mm-hmm. Alongside the whole country. And I think that the opportunity to kind of like, you know, really be able to shape the culture through the work that we publish and how we decide to sell it to the marketplace, you know what I mean? To think about readers and new readers and who's not being served well, you know, and to really say, you know, middle-aged white women are absolutely 100% never going to be the primary place where I focus my gaze.
Right.
But that does not exclude, I can publish books that everyone will really get something from, but to not have to, in a marketing or publicity way, focus it in a specific direction.
Right, of course. Yeah.
That's not about I don't want people to read the books. That's about making sure that people can speak. You know, Kiese Layman is such an extraordinary author. And I think one of the reasons why he's so interesting is because he's writing to black readers.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's often not been the case or the allowance made, you know? I mean, I think Toni Morrison was, you know, famously said it again and again, which was that her work was not directed that way. And yet, mm-hmm. so many of us have read Beloved and The Bluest Eye and Jazz, and these books are a testament to the power of American literature, right? But mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. You know, I think that so many authors have had the luxury of writing to whoever the hell they want.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that writers of color haven't. And then I think also, you know, you'll read a book sometimes and you'll be like, you know, plodding along inside of the story. And then there's a moment where a book just about people, you know, just people. And there's a person at the party and it's like a black woman walked in the door. And that indicates to you that every single other person that will be mentioned by race or otherwise
right.
is not. And that indicates who you're writing to, doesn't it?
Of course, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm excited to sort of really not spend all of my time thinking about.
Well, I feel like it needs to be said, like, we are two middle-aged white ladies, but I think I'm ready to not be the default demographic.
Yeah, I think it's like it's not so much a difference in work, it's a difference in posture. I don't think anybody is saying, like, who cares about you? You don't need to read books.
No.
You know what I mean? Which is, unfortunately, what people have said to black audiences for a long time. But it's like, I think it is more that we need a sort of comprehensive literature, and all of it doesn't need to look at one demo. Because we've been able to sell books to that demo.
And that demo is interested in reading books from all kinds of perspectives as well.
Well, yeah, that demo has to, you know, I think that demo has definitely put some books on the bestseller list. The question again is going to be whether or not that demo keeps putting those books on the lists for years to come or stops again, like in the 60s.
What do you mean?
People were interested. Civil rights was happening. People wanted to feel like they weren't racist. And so they were like, let's read these books about civil rights movement. And then the minute that, you know, sort of that quieted, people go back to, you know, segregation in their cultural consumption again.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like there's a general fatigue and then people like move the needle backwards.
I mean, if you were to look at the bestseller list today, it doesn't look like it did in June. So books are already dropping off. And there's 325 million Americans, right? You know, if everybody was so, you know, comprehensively interested in reading, you know, against type, I think we would maybe see the bestseller list hold stronger longer.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the books that we see that are being published under the bestseller list are like, right, even if it's not by a person of color, you see, you know, white fragility, and you see, you know, how to be an anti-racist. And I think people are looking for instruction, right? Mm-hmm. You know, but again, I want to see books on the bestseller list that are just for readers.
Right.
Like, not books that are, like, being published just by black people to educate white people. That does not say that we have a healthy literary landscape. And I think people want to think that it does, because everybody bought a copy of Ibram's book, which they should. It does not tell us that we have a healthy literary landscape because everybody bought that one book.
No, it has to be, like, a long-standing change.
We're seeing a reaction and not necessarily a shift.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's an important distinction.
Again, it's going to all come down to what people actually do with their dollars and their time over time. And I'll be very encouraged if that actually holds. Extremely.
Are there any other books that you wanted to talk about that you didn't get a chance to talk about?
No, I mean, I just think it's like a really good, you know, there's a bunch of things on my shelf that I'm really excited to dig into that I have not yet read. You know, so Claudia Rankine's Just Us is coming out from Grey Wolf soon, which is going to be very exciting. I don't know if you've read Citizen,
mm-mm,
which was published maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And it's a collection of poetry. And in the back of the book, it's really interesting. She has a page where she adds the names of every black person shot by the police. And so now it's in, it's like, I don't know what printing they're in, but they have to keep printing it every time. Every time they reprint it, they add the new names. And it really does talk about sort of like the way that this country works. And so that's her new book, Just Us, which is about race in America. Is good. And she's extraordinary. I mean, just honestly, one of our most brilliant thinkers, brilliant poets, brilliant writers. That's exciting. Elena Ferrante has a new one called The Lying Life of Adults, which I'm excited about. There's actually a book that a friend sent to me that I have not yet read that I'm very excited by, Disha Filia, which is called The Secret Lives of Church Ladies, which is a collection of short stories. And it's actually published by West Virginia University Press, which is so interesting, and I'm thrilled to read it. Red Pill by Hari Kunzru is coming out soon, and he's always been a favorite author of mine, so that's exciting. There's a lot of great books. You know, it's really a shame that a lot of this work is getting published into this very strange climate, you know?
Yeah, I feel for anybody who has a book coming out right now.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you read your books? Do you still prefer, like, a physical book?
Yes. I'm a physical book reader. Although, you know, I have to read, you know, especially as we're reading manuscripts and whatnot, when the new gig starts, definitely we'll have to be reading electronically a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And so you're going to be overseeing Pantheon and Shocken. And so what do you plan on doing there?
That's a great question. I mean, I don't start until January, and so there's a real long runway. And I think that, you know, people, you know, definitely we're going to be looking at, you know, Pantheon's list and saying, how do we take this, like, historic imprint that's published Marguerite Duras and Günter Grass and Studs Terkel, you know, and Marjane Satrapi and, you know, Art Spiegelman and all of these incredible, extraordinary authors. And how do you, you know, give it a future? How do you honor the past and give it a future is the question. But you also, you know, you work with a team of editors and designers and marketers and publicists, and you come up with that together. So I think it's going to be a really fun project to do that collaboratively. I maybe gave you like a little bit of a disingenuous answer earlier, which is like, I'm so excited to sort of politically do this thing, but I'm mostly just excited to make good books.
Yeah.
And to come up with what these books are going to look like with people. But it's like, but I do want to sort of look at the world as we experience it right now. And I think a lot of people want the cultural landscape to look like what they're comforted by. And I think people don't realize that that excludes a lot. And so it's going to be really exciting to sort of give the sort of excellence treatment, both on the marketing side, publicity side, design side, you know, and have those books look different, you know, and add to, you know, there was a conversation about, Criterion Collection. Did you see that article in the New York Times?
Oh, yeah. Only 9 films in the Criterion.
4 filmmakers are represented. 2 of them are living in the Criterion Collection. And that man who has been the sort of, you know, the head of it has been there since the 80s.
Wow.
You know, and so I think the question is, like, you know, we know, you know, many of us work in quote-unquote excellence, right? You know, sort of like letters, with a capital L. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see what that looks like with 40-year-old black me, you know, getting to sort of sign off on what excellence with a capital E looks like in 2020. And I think that I might have a very different take on that than some of the, than you know, the almost exclusively white decision makers that have been in charge of the canon for time, as, you know, for all the time we've known it to be true.
That feels exciting.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah.
And I hope we all do okay at it. You know, we'll see. Time will tell.
Good luck with it. It's exciting.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
All right. Thank you so much.
I'm really excited to dig into a lot of these recommendations.
Yeah, me too.
Where should we send people if they want to know more about you or read more about you? Or
Twitter is probably the place. I'm Lika Luca, LikaLuca. And that's where I often am found.
Thanks so much for this, Lisa.
Of course. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to Everything is Fine. We are your hosts, Talia Bacassus
and Kim France.
If you like the show, be sure to rate it and write us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you have suggestions for show ideas or anything else, email us at tallyandkim@gmail.com. We also have an Instagram that is EIF Podcast, and you can find Kim on her blog, girlsofacertainage.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.